Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the award-winning writer and actor, Barunka O'Shaughnessy.
Hello.
Hi, Barunka.
Hello, how do you do?
Does anyone ever shorten your name? Do you ever get called Bar or Runk?
Rufus Jones calls me Babs.
Rufus does everyone's
name. Yeah, he does everyone's names in a special way. But Babs was because at some point at university, everyone found out my name means tiny Barbara.
Little Barbara.
Does it?
Yeah, yeah.
Hold me closer, tiny Barbara.
That's me. Because I'm so tiny.
Tiny and wee. And you're probably best known for a lot of...
Being tiny.
Tiny and wee.
Being a tiny Barbara.
Your face was in lots of sketch shows and things and Beehive.
And then it fell off them.
Most later, and your face fell off.
Since then, I've had to hide behind the camera.
Now, since you've been so horribly scarred, you've now gone behind the camera and you do a lot of slightly unsung but brilliant work on things like Julia Davis's Hunderbee and Time Wasters and Up the Women with Jessica Hines and things
that's
like that.
That's right.
And that's rather brilliant, I think, because it doesn't happen often enough. People go and use their writing skills rather than just going off and pimping their face about.
It's true. I'd much rather obviously pimp my face because it's sort of much better rewarded.
There's more money in faces.
There's more money in faces, but there's no control. That's what I like.
You can't control your face.
I can't control where I put my face and how it comes out on the screen. And that I don't like that.
It's a bit random. I suppose the terrible thing, particularly as a female performer, is that people are judging your face so much for a role.
They're judging.
I mean, way
more. Yeah, it's not enough whether you can't just be funny or not funny. You have to also be on a sort of spectrum of attractiveness. You know, whenever you're over here, and I am a freak. So, you know. If I were, that would be great. I'd get a lot of work. But I think I'm somewhere in the middle.
No one wants the middle earning potential.
Yeah, totally.
While we're on...
But not middle enough.
While we're on comedy and faces, in Hunderby, Rufus Jones, in the latest series, he tries to blind himself, doesn't he? Doesn't he punch his
With
own
grief.
Eyes in?
Yeah, out of grief, he blinds himself because his eyes cannot bear to see what he sees.
Yeah.
Which is his beloved wife being unfaithful. He
told us about that just shortly after he filmed it, and he said it was genuinely traumatic because as they were applying the prosthetics, whoever it was said to him, listen, a little word of advice, people are going to treat you very differently when you've got this on your face because you do look atrocious. And he said it was absolutely true. People were just avoiding looking at him. He said it was such a strange transformation. Oh. All these people who, they're professionals, he's working with them on set, but people just couldn't look at him.
Right, because it was too horrific. You think, well, they were quite sort of bloodied and manky. And
they were.
People don't, a lot of people have an aversion to gore, it seems. I don't know why.
I wasn't involved in Shaun of the Dead, but you sort of want to know what the lunch queue was like at Shaun. Well, everyone's got all their faces staved in.
They know it's fake. Everyone knows it's fake, but somehow it's maybe still it's just
Rufus
repulsive.
Is a very, very beautiful man. And maybe he wasn't used to anyone not looking at him in awe.
I think that might be the heart of it.
Imagine just being ordinary looking.
How is this? How can one even exist? Yeah, no, it's very bizarre.
What have you brought for us? Actually, it is related.
Nothing.
Slightly, what? We told you to bring a bottle.
I have nothing to give
you.
It's
a terrible party etiquette. It's related to Hunderby, I think, quite nicely. You've chosen something which I hadn't seen before. And really glad I've now seen.
Oh boy!
It's about too good.
40
times because I can't stop watching
it's too
it now.
Good, isn't
Tell
it?
Us what you've brought in.
I brought a sketch I think it's written by the ensemble that are involved in the Sean McAuliffe program, and it's called Spiffington Mance, and it's just a sort of brilliant clown parody of sort of a parlor scene that you might find in a period drama. And because it's done by Australians, because Sean McAuliffe is Australian, they sort of have an extra edge of a parody to it, I guess.
Contempt?
Yeah, exactly, contempt. But
what's good is we can't play a clip of this. Well, we can play bits of it, but you won't get a single clue as to how this is good, because we're now talking about a visual sketch. It's a sketch that's verbally very inventive as well, but it's mainly what's funny about it is it's visual.
Sit yourself down, Flora. There'll be time enough for hand-wringing later.
And the performers are loving it so much that they're also corpsing slightly, which I always love, but it's beautifully choreographed. I mean, it has to be choreographed. Like, when you see it, you go, this is such a tiny space in which utter chaos basically kind of unfolds in a
The central joke is old-fashioned period houses are very cluttered.
Very cluttered, full of very sort of delicate china clutter.
Things
that are
stands.
Easily swept off cyborgs, as the sketch also insists on calling sideboard. Anyway, it's too brilliant.
Now, girl, don't get yourself into a tither. It'll be... You mustn't distress yourself. Or shall I have to call Dr. Witherspoon?
Anytime anyone moves, or they've obviously
essentially
done...
more and more people enter a very small space that is full of very precious breakable objects.
I think we should describe this, because yes, you can watch it, and of course it's basically it's the same visual joke again and again, which is things.
One idea.
There's too much stuff in here.
There's too much stuff, and
not enough
people
room.
Are wearing very large and obstructive clothing. they're in crinolines, or they have swords at their sides. So
someone brings in a giant bunch of flowers, and then
everyone enters
a huge Irish wolf.
Everyone enters with an excessively large prop into a very small space full of very fragile objects, and whilst also maintaining a very dignified sort of manner appropriate to the age, which is
the McAuliffe program is live in front of an audience, which gives it a lovely feel. Yeah. If you did this like a single camera, exactly like a period drama, but this looks more like a sort of 1980s adaptation of Jane Eyre with Timothy Dalton in it, kind of BBC
I think that might be
look.
The sort of heart of the parody. I guess that's what they're sort of mainly lampooning.
Because it's a set. It's a BBC set with all the stuff from the BBC props department in it. And what's great about it is that the cast and the audience hit a rolling hysteria.
Because the props become more and more absurd. The props brought in become more and more absurd. You go, please, there cannot be any more humans or props in this room.
He'll be arriving from London soon. And you can't fit another person onto this pokey. It's a parody of a television centre set.
It is. It's too good.
It did put me in mind of Tom Meaton and James Barkman, who are two people you know.
intimately.
Wrote some sketches for Mitchell and Webb called Martin's Tiny Office, where David Mitchell played a guy whose office was almost probably no bigger than the door opening would have allowed it to be, but the door couldn't open, and it was just a series of sketches in which more and more stuff was crammed in. There's one nice one where someone has accused someone else of sexual harassment in the workplace. office. So Sarah Hadland is in this office with, but bent over the desk because there's no room for her, with her head on David Mitchell's chest, with Robert Webb basically almost mounting her from behind. And the door to the office opens and a ladder comes in because a maintenance guy has arrived.
I feel a little bit uncomfortable sometimes with the touching.
I thought I was just being, friendly.
There you go, Mike. She was just being friendly. And
I know this seems like a lot of fuss about nothing, but I honestly think if I were a woman...
Maintenance! Oh, yep, come on in.
Oh, I'm really not comfortable with...
Mike, it's fine. They're just doing something with the wires in the ceiling and none of them can speak any English anyway.
Sorry.
Once you get what the joke is, and the joke's deployed quite early, you go, you get that lovely pause at the beginning of a parody sketch where you go, what's the joke they're going to play? They drop that in and the audience go, I know what's going to happen. And then the delight is not really surprise. It's going,
Oh, you did it.
And another
one.
And again.
Absurd.
And in that way, it reminded me beautifully of Mr. Show's The Story of Everest sketch, which if you haven't seen, we will put links up to these on the website, whatever. But The Story of Everest, which is the same thing happening again and again, almost like the fade out of Hey Jude. It just keeps going, no, for about 12 minutes.
Yeah.
And once you've seen it happen once, the only thing you can't predict is not what's going to happen, but when it's going
to
happen.
You have to ride the wave of insistence.
You're pulled in a rhythm. There's a great thing going on with Spiffington Mance, as well as the dialogue on one level, which is very measured and very well delivered, and a good Stephen Fry level pastiche of how Jane Austen sounds.
Lovely sort of absurdist touches. The as I said, the sideboard being referred to as a cyborg throughout.
A cyborg?
Entirely without. No one notices. No one acknowledges that they're referring to the cyborg.
But that trips along on the top, and that's almost like your little melody lines running.
Yeah.
And then underneath it is this sort of jazz riff of Foley and things smashing and crashing. And it gives it a rhythm that's disjointed. You never know when the next bang's going to come.
Perhaps you should be lying down.
A recuperative brandy will slake her vapours. Fetch it at once, woman. It's on the sideboard.
The cyborg?
Oh, I'll get myself.
Come, dear. You should be lying down.
Begging your pardon, ma'am. Captain Billing Smythe is here to pay a call on Daisy, ma'am.
Oh, well, then you and Fetch her at once, Mrs. Broom.
And it will come in the middle of someone's very well-balanced, rhythmic, dumpty-dumpty line.
It's our expectation of the kind of British etiquette that you never let it slip. There's a brilliant scene in Carry On Up the Khyber. I don't know if you remember the dinner party scene. And they're being sort of attacked by Afghan rebels.
The Qazi of Calabar.
Of course, the Qazi. How could I forget? That's what they were called. And meanwhile, they're just enjoying this very lovely dinner, lovely supper party.
Roy Castle's getting bits of ceiling in his suit.
They're all getting ceiling, and then Joan Sims has a cleavage full of plaster that's fallen off the ceiling. And they just carry on as if everything went absolutely fine.
What's odd, when you rewatch Carry On, a lot of it isn't very good. And I always remember that as a reminder that within Carry On, there are terrific sketches.
There are
sketch writers and sketch performers.
Yeah.
And they're just terrific when they're allowed to just do a sketch.
Mm.
It's just wonderful.
This is the comedy equivalent of going past the junction you were meant to turn off at on the motorway and going, okay, well, I can't turn around, so I've just got to keep going in this direction now. I've got to go through with this. So once things start falling over and getting smashed, you go,
just stick with it. Bigger and crazier.
More and more things come into the room. It's quite clever. I noticed when I was watching it for about the 15th time, because it is so rewatchable, that the first wide shot you get is 35 seconds in. So it's only 35 seconds in when you get the first wide and you go, oh my God, the room's absolutely fucking packed.
Yeah.
And that's when you get a sense of, okay, I think I see what's going to happen here. Yeah.
Where all these tiny ornaments are going to get.
And there's things like, when you're in a tiny space like this, you can bring things in. That's obviously the first gag that they do. More and more people, and then the hound, and and the big bunch of flowers. But then there's things like, then what's her name? It's Flora, isn't it? She starts playing the harpsichord, and two of them dance a jig around the room.
Join me in this dance.
Oh, please, no. And he has a sword at his side, which continues to sweep everything.
And he puts out his hand and he picks up, he gets the cake stand caught on his sleeve, doesn't he? It's like
that. Too good.
But then I suppose it's based on a very, very simple, basic comic premise, which is pure clowning, which is that they are high status people. They're very, very aloof and they're doing a high status program and they're behaving like bad builders. They're
and not acknowledging it, though. It's that brilliant sort of lack of acknowledgement of the chaos around you, because they are high status. They're sort of impermeable. There's nothing that would ever, you know, ever sort of ruffle them in any
way.
It's just for us to enjoy.
And there's a lovely thing with this, that these people are obviously not only in the Jane Austen-y world, but even if they were the cast of a BBC costume drama, they've done so many of these that they've stopped noticing when you knock over the furniture.
But also, it's the rule of theatre, you know, if you're in a serious play, you just simply can't stop and adjust and go, oh, terribly sorry, I've dropped a prop. You just plough on through, carry on.
It's a keep calm and carry on sketch. It's a joke on Britain.
English specifically, I guess.
But being Australian, if you've not seen McAuliffe, it's just probably the great lost sketch show that people... It's like Mr. Show was for a while, where people sort of said, have you seen Mr. Show? Oh. And it was a sketch show that in Britain, not many people had seen. I think this was on Paramount or something.
Actually, James Bartman introduced me to it, so maybe that's why he was... writing homages.
Yeah.
But yeah, we watched a whole load of them in a row and they were just excellent. And he's just like a master clown, really. And the thing I love about him is that he's in the vein of Sean McAuliffe. He's in the vein of Partridge and Howard Moon and Rigby. You go, he's an incredibly high status idiot.
He's pompous.
He's so pompous, but you can never pop him. But he just kind of remains aloof and an absolute idiot. And there's another series of sketches that in the show which run and are incredible to watch, like visually, the Tilted Room sketches.
Unbelievable.
Good grief. The wine
They were the first thing
phenomenal.
I was shown by someone.
Yeah, the first time you see it, you go, how the fuck?
Have
they done it? This is it. This is actually
it's
physically
such a
drunk
big build, isn't it?
And you realise they've built the whole set on an angle so that gravity doesn't work. And it's just, the first sketch is in the first episode. He comes home and his wife says, have you been drinking? But for sort of 3 minutes before then,
she's lying on the sofa, so you
can't tell.
Just don't know. And it takes you a while to work out the fact that the room is at an angle. The whole set is at an angle.
It's a rotating set, and the camera is bolted to the rotate, isn't it?
So that
your perspective never changes, but the centre of gravity is moving around the screen.
And it's absolutely mind-boggling. So when he goes to the cellar to get some wine, and then suddenly he's basically just, if you imagine the whole set is rotating, so he's trying to get a bottle of wine while sort of occasionally hanging from the set and then sort of collapsing onto it as the room shifts.
It's like a drunk version of Gravity, the film.
It's
just you can't quite tell which way up you are.
And there's a sliding ladder. I mean, it's just, it is phenomenal. You go, he's an acrobat and a clown.
It's an on-set sketch show. He's presenting it and there's an audience and it's all at the level of reality that people come on wearing a hat. Yeah. It's not that full makeup Little Britain filmed sketches. These are review sketches done
facets
on the set
of McAuliffe.
Yeah, and so you're expecting it to be fairly cheap because that's how these things, they look. Yeah. They don't look, you're not meant to think any of this is real. Mm. And there's great moments where he just keeps pulling in props and rooms and builds and sets that are 10 times as ambitious as you're expecting. And that takes you by surprise. And it reminded me right in my heart what's brilliant about sketch compared to any other form of comedy is that when you're playing surprise with it, anything can happen on a sketch show because you won't break the reality of the world. You don't break the reality of the world by saying cyborg in a Jane Austen sketch. No one goes, oh, I'm out of the sketch now, you've ruined it, which you would do if you were doing Hunderby. It would ruin it. But you can constantly be popping things and changing people's expectations.
Well, that's a call you make, isn't it? You make your own rules. So you go, for example, Hunderby, you go, we decided early on, no anachronisms. You go, we're absolutely solidly in this world and we will not break it and we will not refer to the future world.
Because it's fragile. You don't want to break people's appreciation of it. And the joy of a sketch show is you can shift gear in something where everyone's expecting it to be just two people sitting at a desk because it's quite a cheap show. And suddenly you go, oh, the desk's upside down. They've built the whole set out. Things like budgetary decisions, set decisions, prop decisions can really shock you and surprise you and keep you on your toes. And it makes you giggle. You're in a constant state of fizz.
The thing I miss about sketch, or that I miss with McAuliffe, is you go, the sort of the character, the the engaging with his character or engaging with the characters, you know, unfortunately you don't have room for that in a sketch.
But I want
his host character, the kind of anchor. You obviously get to love them, but you never know, like, you never understand his world, his reality, apart from occasionally, you know, who might say, my family were invited tonight and they didn't turn up. But I want more of that, you know, in the way that you obviously get with someone like Howard Moon, where you go, he's in a narrative and you can laugh at him, but you could sort of love him all the more.
It's the sacrifice
I want to feel more for Mikhailov.
It's the sacrifice you make to
I
get
wish
that.
I could feel more for him, but I'm dead inside.
Well, it goes without saying, if only we could. Sadly, convention dictates we must mention it. I don't apologise for that. I'm sorry, but I don't. Now, can I just mention before we go, Irene Chenoweth, who's in our audience tonight. She's 107 years old. Where are you, Irene? 107 years old! Well, audiences are fickle, Irene, what can I tell you?
The character he's chosen, which is, you said Partridge, and I went, it's amazing, I hadn't even noticed how Partridge he was.
I think it must have been at the same time as Knowing Me, Knowing You.
It's 98.
Yeah, so when was Knowing Me, Knowing You?
But I think that's sort of slightly
a bit earlier, isn't it?
But I think he's obviously informed by a lot of British comedy. He's a big Python fan, big Goons fan. His character that he's chosen to be, which is very sort of aloof and high status and arrogant.
Yeah.
You don't notice as a character at first, because sketch shows don't usually have a character anchor.
No.
And then he starts doing brilliant things, like where he doesn't know what to say to a blind guy on set. And that's just pure Alan Partridge.
Yes.
There's sketches where he's...
The guests on the sofa.
He's allowed to be rude to them. Where he gets voted most sexiest man in Australia and is correcting the grammar until someone points out it's most sexist man in Australia.
He's a pig. But he would never... As I say, he's unpoppable. You can't... No one ever brings him down. Like, he's such an ego, but a brilliant idiot and very suave. He looks quite good as well. That helps.
He does.
He's a good looking man.
The deal I was seeing with him is he was 36 when he did this, and he just switched to comedy. He used to be a solicitor. He's an insurance solicitor.
Hence those excellent courtroom sketches.
And he knows his stuff, but he comes from a thing of authority. He's gone prematurely grey.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, you're Dermot Morgan and you're Steve Martin. And you can play authority figures because you were one, which is a bit what you get with Stephen Fry, where he's quite young but can play headmasters because he's a bit headmasterly. Mm. And he feels a bit teachery. And then when he's naughty, because actually he's only in his early 30s when he starts doing comedy, and he's got the naughtiness of a young person, but he looks like someone's dad or a teacher. And it's so subversive. It's so funny. It never
I think that's
fails.
What I love about this, well, his character, and as I say, the Moon and Rigby and Partridge, you go, they're male authority figures, but they're idiots and they don't know they're idiots. And so we have the tremendous pleasure of seeing what idiots they are. And personally, I can't abide male authority figures. So for me, it's like a real kind of, this is my favourite type of clown, the high status, pompous twat, basically being.
That's a standard clown in classic.
It's a very hard clown to do, actually. Not many people can pull off high status, because if you think about it, it's like, you know, your automatic clown mode is just to sort of fall over and be a dick and people laugh at you. But to be able to maintain authority in a scene and still be funny is a rare skill, and it's absolutely necessary for all the other idiots around you to be able to play off.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jewellery, might I remind you that we no longer live in the age of the steam engine and the straw hat, and that if it is a crime for my client to kill a man in cold blood, then my client is guilty. But if it is not a crime, then he isn't. The end. It's looking good.
I sentence you to death.
I love the fact that the photo of him on the wall of the set.
Oh, with the eyes closed. I mean, there are so many brilliant touches in the set, I don't really know anything about him, and I sort of have failed to do any research about him.
Well done.
I was hoping that you'd probably do that. There's so many sort of theatrical tropes in his show, in the Mikhailov programme, like loads of sort of live clowning tropes that I don't know how much he sort of was involved with it before.
He's very visual as well, isn't he? And I was thinking, the sketch that you brought in, the...
Spiffington Mance,
thank you. I was going for Puffington for a minute there for some reason. Spiffington Mance. On the page, that wouldn't read like much at all, would it?
No, not at all.
And in fact, it's a bit like ditto the wine cellar. Yeah. What does that look like on the page? Yeah, it's not really... It's almost unscriptable, isn't it, really? It's just a kind of... Look, this is the concept.
But that's what I mean about the choreography. You go... You had to work that out, surely. That was hours of falling around. And there's another tilted room sketch he does. He's introducing a history programme, but with the room at an angle. is essentially upside down, I think, in this one. And he's trying to sort of look dignified and sits on a desk and then eventually ends up sliding off the desk and crashing feet first into a bookcase and stamping on all the books and the ornaments. But what is brilliant about him when you watch that is that he's still clocking the camera because he's still a professional. He's still got to do his job, presenting the programme before then jumping out of the door and disappearing.
We watched one this morning, which I think is the quickest sketch I've ever seen, and it's fucking amazing. He simply walks on and says to camera, "Now, I don't often do this on the programme," and then he's yanked violently off the set out of a plate glass window.
It's better than that because he's picking up a guitar.
Oh my god, yeah.
He's reaching for it. Now, I don't often do this on the program.
Crash.
Flies out of a window.
It is so excellent. There are so many good jokes like that.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Do you write lots of visual stuff?
Do I write lots of visual stuff? Yes.
Because you're a good clown. I mean, the first time I ever saw you was on stage and you you stood out as an obviously a really good, natural, comfortable clown.
Yes, you were doing a show clown. With James Barkman and Lucy Montgomery.
And I was going to say, actually, Lucy Montgomery was one of the rare things, which was a high status clown.
Yes.
So she she led very well. In the first show we did, Wicker Woman, it wasn't the first show we did, but the first show we talk about, the first one we don't discuss. The Wicker Woman, and she essentially was the sort of the lead, and she played one character throughout. But again, she was a high status idiot, but she was in charge. She was a policewoman. And I think it's really hard to pull off. And then she didn't like that, so she did more characters in the next show we did because she didn't want to be.
It's always
she wanted
a problem.
To play, have more fun. And you go, but you don't know how good you are at this.
And it's
thing.
A rare skill.
And we need it.
We don't write a lot of visual. I have to say, we're quite wordy. We did write a really nice visual one once, which is, again, it's in description, it doesn't mean much, but you can see this. So picture this. It's a theme park, sort of Chessington-style theme park, and there's a big plushy mascot waving, and there's like the sound of children enjoying themselves, and a couple of kids go up and get their photo taken with the mascot, and the mascot standing there waving. And then it cuts to inside the plushy costume looking out, and all you can hear is the sound of the person inside the costume sobbing their heart out.
No one wants to make that one.
That's brilliant. What do you mean no one's made it?
It's ludicrous, isn't it?
Can you believe
there's not a market for that sketch?
Why not?
We did one which about three... Because visual sketches, very often they're quickies and they're conceptual.
Don't worry, I'll steal your idea and put it in a scene.
Do it.
Please.
Okay.
But we found that visual sketches, there's a high premium on them because they're very... they're good for trailers and that people like them. They snap out quickly. They're
advertising.
Del Boy falling through the bar, isn't it? But they like that. So when you write one, we had one which went to about three different sketch shows, which is a really simple one, which ended up with Armstrong and Miller, but David and Robert tried to do it. And it was just someone doing a driving test and the driving instructor saying, when I smack the dashboard, I want it to break as if a small child has run out in front of the car. And then he does it, and someone runs in front of the car, and they run the person over, and then he hits the dashboard, and the guy breaks, and he goes, very well done. So basically, you had someone bounce off the bonnet and shatter the windscreen. And that went round to about three sketch shows. Went, we want to do this. It's a really simple visual joke. It'll bang. It will be clippable. And it was. But they found it was just so expensive to smash
practical.
A window of a car.
I know. Always
visual stuff's expensive.
Very. Yeah. You can't smash all the windows on a train, for example, or a tall building.
Have you suggested that?
Yes.
Have you really?
Of course.
What was that for?
God, what was that? It was a sketch show called Three Wheelin', which
ooh,
I was...
Good.
Ooh, nice.
Ooh, good.
Which I was involved with. And there was a sketch which John Hopkins wrote, actually. And then we sort of elaborated. And it was about two Brummies with very high-pitched voices whose voices get higher and higher until all glass smashes around them. we too were told that it was too expensive to smash glass.
They do it in Avengers.
Come on, do it in post. Do it in post.
What's the most stupid thing you've asked for that someone's given you?
Look, two ice swans.
Two,
I was so
one.
Annoyed. It was that conversation you always have with producers going, we can't afford anything, don't write anything ambitious. And then they go, we want the scripts to be ambitious. And so you go, all right, well, here we go. And as a joke, I wrote in the script, because Daniel Lawrence Taylor and I were laughing about this, I went, I've put two ice swans in it. Ha ha. But apparently they're not that expensive.
Really?
They made them and
wow.
had them on
wow.
set.
Because you're always surprised
they
at
said,
what's
actually,
expensive.
Well, I say what's expensive, humans.
People.
Yeah,
humans are
true,
expensive.
True.
You know,
we once we wrote
ice,
we wrote some
humans.
We wrote someone building built a homemade gun out of guttering and something or other, hadn't they? We wrote this thing in, and we went down to the set, and there was an armourer there who had built this fucking thing, and it fired stuff. You know,
well, we didn't mean
an
that
actual armourer.
We meant a bit of drain pipe
with a rubbish gun.
With a toy gun on the end of it.
Yeah,
they do that.
Sometimes they get carried away. I think art departments are incredible. I've yet to meet an art department that isn't amazing, and their jokes are often brilliant as well. Like that, you'll always get one of them who loves the idea of creating visual jokes where there weren't any.
Yep. Well, you're allowed to.
And they decorate the set beautifully.
Watching them be busy. And
the extra jokes. So you always have to read the signs behind people's
always.
Heads.
Yep.
And
yep.
you always find them.
We used to do
an art department
pass on a lot of stuff for Charlie. You'd finish the script and then you'd be on holiday having finished something. And they'd say, quick, 400 things that could be on a sign in a bank. And you just... Well, I remember writing lots of them on our phones.
You'd just send a list on an email.
Oh, it's such a joy. And then you see it.
Made real. But the weird thing that things that are expensive, we were told once on something, we wanted to do a heist scene and we wanted someone to pick up a big bag of money, like you see in gangster movies, a big bag full of notes. And the art department went, it's more expensive to get fake notes than use real ones. I went, That's definitely not true. Otherwise, our currency would be art department notes. But I love that as an excuse for why we can't be bothered to make loads of £10.
Right. Oh, because you're not allowed to photocopy them, are you?
Yeah, I think it was. But apparently there was a thing like, whenever you ask for something like a rubber snooker ball, the budget the art department comes to, it's £1,000 for a fake snooker cue. And you go, really?
Yeah.
And you miss the days. Someone said this in reply to when we talked about Bottom on the podcast. They said a lot of the props for that were made by the in-house BBC props department, which must have saved them a fortune.
Yeah.
Because getting them from prop houses is so expensive. And I was looking at Swiffington Mance and thinking, what you've got is there is a parody of a lost way of making television where there was loads of furniture and a scenery dock downstairs that had been used for Oliver Twist and Bleak House and Jane Eyre. And if you wanted to fill a small set with every piece of Jacobean furniture or whatever that you could get, they'd just bring it up.
But it was pre-vintage era, so actually you could find lots of china in a shop. Because Tom and I tried to recreate the atmosphere of Spiffington Mance.
In your house?
No. We did it on stage, Tom Meaton and I, when we used to perform together. Before we reproduced.
That's the end of that.
That was the end of that.
You don't want to see each other anymore.
We don't laugh anymore. We did this sketch where we were an unhappy couple. Basically, all our sketches involved unhappy couples trying to get away from each other. And this couple were like porcelain collectors. And it was a live sketch. And the idea being that at some point, he or I would lose our shit and smash all the porcelain. And so we went around all the charity shops collecting up as many porcelain figurines as we could. And we tried it out live at the Hen and Chickens. Unfortunately, we nearly blinded several people in the front row. Because it turns out if you chuck a porcelain figurine across the stage, it doesn't just smash nicely and satisfyingly like a Greek taverna plate. It just kind of bits just sort of shard off and into people's eyes.
It's like a grenade.
So that's why I really appreciate the amount of work that went into Spiffington Mance, because you go, it's so beautifully choreographed.
And no one died.
Nobody lost their sight, I don't think.
Captain! Oh, welcome!
Yes. Thank you very much, ma'am, Mrs. Pollock. It is an unalloyed delight to meet you as always.
Oh, you're quite a surprise. Of course, you know my younger daughter, Flora.
Yes, indeed. Absolute abject pleasure to meet you.
I try not to go on set.
Do you?
I don't like to see what people have done with the lovely words I wrote.
Oh, really?
You just got used to it.
It's always disappointing, no matter what. You know how you visualise it. In your head, you imagine it in such a certain way. And then directors come along and performers.
Is it compromise, or is it just you that you want to step in? Because you've done stuff when you started out and you were sort of running your own group, as it were, and performers. Yeah. When you go and do Edinburgh shows and things, you'd have control.
Yeah. Take more of this, it's all about control, isn't it, really?
So do you find it hard to sit back?
Yeah. And then I get asked to leave set. I've often been asked to leave.
Will you leave?
Really?
Yeah, because I'm just a pain in the arse and I get over-involved.
Do you keep suggesting changes?
I just go, that's not the way. Anyway, I've learned now.
Are you judgmental?
I am, yeah, totally. It's like, I wouldn't have done it like that. I think, well, actually, you know, either direct it yourself or fuck off, essentially. You know,
let people
I think it's healthier for me to stay away.
No, that's actually quite
it's healthier
nice thing.
For me. It's healthier for them.
the production will
better
be finished.
All
no, one
everyone.
Will get, no one will get china in their eye. No. It's much, much easier.
But
it's,
no
it's
one a, will fall out.
There's a mutual respect thing there, which I think a lot of writers moan about. And you go, I think I know to stand well clear once the machinery starts going. But then in return, you go, will you leave my script alone? I've done my bit to the best of my ability. And if you do your bit to the best of your ability, together we'll give 100%.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you see a performer actually sort of breathe life into something where you go, oh, I didn't even think of that particular nuance, then that's pretty amazing.
When everyone's bringing their A game.
Yeah, totally.
You want to trust people.
It's just when you're on set, it's kind of annoying. I find being on set very irritating anyway. All that hanging around.
It's boring, isn't it?
It's so boring.
Being on set is very
boring.
It's
like a weird sort of limbo.
When did you first go on set?
When did I first go on set? I think it might have been it was an advert I did with Collie Coleman, Lydia Coleman and I, for the National Lottery, as it was called then.
Right.
And I was so nervous, I could barely speak, and I got that weird sort of brain freeze thing that happens where you have such a panic attack that you can't think of anything. And then I did a comedy lab with Gareth Tunney called Tracy and I, written by Seb Barwell. Quite a fun shoot. It was all very low key and low budget. We had an extraordinary director called Tom Collins. Anyway, his direction involved going, ah, you're all right. yeah, you're all right. So Gareth would go, should I be here? What should I do in this scene? Yeah, you're all right. Which I think is the best kind of directing. Anyway, so that was my first go. But that was fun.
Was it a shock? Had you been on set to visit things as a kid or anything?
Never.
This is the first time?
Never. I mean, it was a studio set, so it was quite sort of locked in and hemmed in and not very exciting, very low key. So out in Greenford on the edges of London. We had to get the tube in as well. It wasn't like it really was very, very non-glamour. In fact, none of it's glamorous, though, ever. You're usually just sort of sweating and moaning. And there's a weird sort of mental limbo you go into where you can't do anything else other than just sit and wait between scenes. And you're not allowed to go anywhere. So you're always being sort of corralled and harangued by an AD to stay put and stay in a caravan or in a... or in a holding area. You're not allowed any independence. I think that's why I came to hate it. And also the scrutiny is pretty agonising. If you're in a lot of scenes, if you're on set all the time, everyone's looking at you. They basically are all looking at you. They're only looking at you through a lens, but through their own eyes. Everyone's staring at you, waiting for you to do a thing. And suddenly that made me feel a bit sort of unnerved. I started feeling very odd about
that.
How
was that different than performing in front of an audience? Because you were very confident live.
Oh yeah, that was, but that's all right. You kind of, you react immediately and you know when it's going badly, you know when it's going well, and it's all entirely, you're in control again because you're in control of the room and you're in control of the people in front of you and your own performance, and you don't have to do it again until the next night.
Do you feel out of control when you're on camera?
Yeah. And scrutinised as well. That's the thing. It's the scrutiny.
You've got an audience, haven't you, when you're being filmed, and it's not your audience.
But it's not your audience.
They're bored.
And they don't care. And they're there doing a job. And you can see all around you people waiting and waiting to get on with the next bit of their job. And they're not there for you. And they're not there to be entertained. God. And that's really odd. So you go, you're giving a performance that no one wants.
It must be against their will. This audience hate me.
Everyone is obliged to watch.
It must be a bit of a struggle then to try to maintain your performance, especially if it's a comic performance.
You do. Well, that's where you rely on your co-performers, if you're lucky enough to have any around you. And then that's the sort of camaraderie. And if that's gone, if you're not getting on with them, then you're screwed, really. So
that's another reason I used to find it traumatic as a writer. You always want to go on set as a writer. I want to be treated as part of this production. When I get to the wrap party, I want people to know who I am. And I'm saying to editors and writers, the people who everyone's introduced to at the wrap party, sorry, who are you? I wrote it.
I
fixed it at the end. We both made this work. But you've never met anyone. You want to go on set. And you go on set and you realise all you're watching is these things you thought were really funny go down really badly again and again and again for ages when no one's in the mood for it.
Yeah.
And it's actually like, it's, oh God, do you want to go and watch your jokes die?
Flip side of that is when everyone's finding it hilarious and you're all laughing, you're all corpsing, and even the cameraman is wobbling with laughter, and you go, well, you know for a fact that will not be funny on screen. What is funny in the room will never translate to the finished product.
It's a hard decision as well. You get back when people do a lot of stuff where they keep the script loose and do a bit of improvisation. And I always think that's mainly to keep the crew interested. So that they're not going through the motions. There's a sense of danger and a bit of edge, and it feels a bit more live. Because actually, the stuff... I remember the first edit we ever got back of a Kunk. We'd sent Diane out to be filming a Kunk.
Yeah.
And she came back, and the first edit had all the stuff we'd written in the room that Diane delivered had been edited down to a small, tiny bit of it. And all the stuff that she'd done with the academics, where it was off the cuff, had been left really long, like 7 or 8 minutes long.
Because it feels
I remember just saying,
fresh and real.
Saying, that's all new to you. But actually, that's nowhere near as good as the stuff that we'd worked out before. You've got to trust that the actual jokes were really funny. And they did a re-edit and they balanced it back up and it was much better. But the original one was, the improv was really long because everyone had hooted at it on set.
Right, yeah.
And actually, some of those jokes were weaker.
It's not that crafted. Yeah.
Did you visit the Hunderby set then?
I did a couple of times, yeah.
Was that a happy set?
Well, as in all comedy that's a bit ambitious in terms of production... It was a stressed set because they're always trying to film 1,000 scenes in one day, and there's always someone who's pressuring someone, and it's quite hard to sort of relax and laugh. But I think basically the chemistry between Julia and Rufus is such that they had a lot of fun. I mean, I always have fun visiting like that because I can just sort of burble on and leave very quickly. And I just go, hey, everyone, hi, hi, and then go.
It's like turning up for week 3 of Edinburgh and being annoying.
Exactly. Yes, yes, exactly that. But yeah, I think it was actually a happy set. Amongst the performers, they all got on brilliantly.
Ah, Dorothy.
Your bubbly milk, sir.
Thank you. Dorothy, be sure to instruct Jeff on how to frothy my milk every part for Fiji. I can live without comforts, but bubbly milk is not one of them.
When you're doing a pastiche like that is pitch perfect, it was all done in natural light, wasn't it?
The cinematography
is incredible. But it will be done for a comedy budget, as it always is, rather than a drama budget. But you're parodying something which has got a budget double what you've got.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
But it's got to look exactly the same, because otherwise the joke doesn't work.
Well, certainly the demand is from commissioners and executives is that they do require a standard of production that is kind of impossible to achieve on the budgets. But it's expected now. And I think technically it's easier to do that now. But it's still, it's a fraction of drama budgets, which, makes me want to go into drama.
Well, we were at a BAFTAs thing a couple of years ago, and they were showing that big screen thing that came up and said, this is the best that British television has got to offer. Here's a 5-minute collage with some Coldplay underneath it, whatever it was. A montage of bits and bobs. It got to the end of it. I thought there wasn't a single frame of comedy in this. And I thought, are you ashamed of what it looks like?
Yeah, maybe.
Because it doesn't look as sexy. And I thought, well, they've got Detectorists and Catastrophe, and they're beautiful for the
it's
money.
It's a much maligned genre. I think certain commissioners, or the higher you go, the sort of less kind of comedy experience they have, or comedy production experience they have, and they're slightly terrified of jokes because they don't understand humour. And they sort of go, I don't have an opinion, I don't know how you judge comedy, because it's so subjective. Yeah. It's like judging music. They sort of panic and go, no. Do I want this? No. Yes.
They can find reasons, though, can't they? They can say, this, like, you can get a
We've
factual
got one like
reason.
This.
We've got one of these. This won't appeal to this demographic, whatever it is. Those are all factual things. But, but I didn't find this funny as a matter of opinion, not a matter of fact.
Yes.
So it's a difficult one to get through.
So when you have a very humourless head of channel, it's a tricky
Well, a lot of them
obstacle.
Have come through sort of on a natural history and factual.
Yeah.
Because there's less comedy being made as well. So the people who rise to the top tend to have been very successful in formatted television and things. And they're brilliant at that. But it's a very different kind of brain that takes a chance on comedy. So less and less is getting made.
I remember one commissioner, unnamed, who didn't know what to say after watching a live sketch for a show that was already commissioned on their channel. And they said, they watched the sketch and they went, oh, look at that. I mean, how do they remember all the words?
Wow.
They learned the scripts because they're performers. It was pretty damning. They just panicked because they just didn't know what to say. They didn't have a comedy opinion. They didn't have, I presume, a sense of humour. Otherwise, they would have gone, it's not my kind of thing. I like this and this, but whatever, well done.
But it's a big, I mean, I'm thinking it's a ballsy thing to put your neck on the line and say, I find this funny, particularly when very much decisions are now made by committee. So basically, not only have you got to say you like it, but 20 other people of different departments have got to say they like it as well. But they won't put their neck on the line about these things, because actually it feels really stupid to say, I laughed at that and no one else did. And then you realise that everyone you're working with has got a performance or writing background and has been through that fear, has stood up on stage and told a joke that's died. And yet the people you're doing it for are much more timid than that and have tended to go, it's about cakes, it looks beautiful, and they've taken a risk with formatting or with casting, but they've never taken a risk on whether a room full of people are just going to go, piss off.
Yeah, they panic, don't they? They panic.
I only realised recently that a lot of the people I was talking to who were very high up in management and very, very good at making television, as it were not the sort of people who made birthday cards for friends. They bought a purple Ronnie card.
That's an interesting Venn diagram you've
and
done.
I thought since I was a child, I've made birthday cards for friends with stupid jokes on I hope they'd laugh at, and sometimes they don't.
Right.
And I've gone, fine with that.
If you're high status, you probably haven't made a career out of failing, which I suppose you do as a comedian. You kind of have avoided at all costs failing. And
failing doesn't kill you. Which is the first thing you learn as anyone who writes a joke no one laughs at. If you're a performer, you've done it in front of an audience. And if you're a writer, you've done it in a room full of your peers who you pitched a joke in and everyone's gone and moved on. So you go, I'm still alive. And actually that risk is...
We've never hit a failure we didn't learn from either, surely. No. You know, you really do learn from failure. It's
well, if anything, it just
helpful.
Sort of bruises you until you can't feel the pain anymore.
Like Rufus's eyes.
Exactly. I think that's why... you know, traditionally women have been, have sort of balked at entering a room of male writers. Mm. You just go, wow, there's so much judgment and pain lined up here. And as a socially programmed creature that wants to please, this is like hell. You know, you're going to fail and people are not going to laugh at your jokes. It's going to be agony.
Were you really terrified by it at first?
Just the world of seemingly super confident men. Although I guess I came at it from the Cambridge angle, which is full of arrogant dicks. You know, they go to private schools where they're taught debating skill. Like, they just, from day one, they are told that they are better at everything. And I think you believe that after a while. And I'm sure it's the same with, I don't know if girls are taught that way now in private schools, but it's a that confidence, to have that confidence from day one is amazing.
Ed Morris, our friend, is a BBC producer, said, it was a lovely observation. He said, I've only just realised that posh people are confident because they know the other posh people are lying and faking this as well.
Yeah,
whereas if you're not posh, if you're not from that entitled thing, if you've not got that, whatever it is, being male, being educated a certain way, whatever, that whatever gives you that confidence, you think as an outsider, God, they're really confident. Whereas a confident person goes, I'm faking this. And I know that my boss and that guy over there and the producer, they're all
I'm
faking
part of
it too.
The club. I'm part of the fake club. This. I don't know. I think it's an amazing skill. I really hope my daughter grows up with it. I don't know how I'm going to do it, though. I don't know how I'm going to instill that in her.
Shout at her.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Is that what you do? Yeah. Beat her. Yeah. No, but I sort of admire it because you go, you don't have that unnecessary veneer of fear and self-doubt and you just get on with it. And then, as you say, you can fail away and just sort of shine in your own sort of whatever area, even if it's not universal, you know. I don't think I'll ever write
it. Was it just failing enough to realise that you were surviving?
How did I get over it? I went to a therapist and took some antidepressants.
They should give you those in the writing room, shouldn't they? Sorry, would you like to come talk to the therapist for a bit? You've been very quiet.
Hand them out at puberty.
I was having a look at Sean McAuliffe on YouTube, and there was a breakfast show appearance on there that he did where he completely disrupted the interview and put me straight in mind of Kenny Everett or Michael Barrymore, who used to do those, appear on chat shows and just, or Rod Hull, you know, and then damage the chat show.
The Australian Freddie Starr.
And I thought that was interesting because it's clear that he is prepared just to be silly.
But was the interviewer uncomfortable? Because that's when I can't bear to watch it. Like Rod Hull and Emu, you just go, oh, you're making another human so uncomfortable right now. How can you bear it? And that I find quite hard to watch. Was it like that or not?
It was quite light-hearted, you know. Who was it who suggested that we took the footage of Rod Hull and Emu on Parkinson, put it into an edit suite and painted out the bird so that it was just Rod Hull's hand attacking Michael Parkinson?
That's such a good idea.
Because I said,
It's such a funny idea.
What he worked out was he was a jester. I mean, he had jester's hair. He was like a clown, pure clown. And what he was doing was a thing that a jester was allowed to do, which is go up to the king and hit him with a pig's bladder on a stick.
Yeah.
And you look at Rod Hull's career, and what he's doing is he's going on places that are very respectable, like the Royal Variety Performance, and he's attacking Princess Margaret or whatever. And we gave him license because he had a bird in his hand to just punch people we thought were a bit up themselves.
Yeah.
Steal their shoes.
I think it's a national, there should be a emu operator laureate, a position constantly to go and punch people who've got, I still want to see like Frost Nixon, Parkinson Emu, done as a really serious film with the two of them face to face on the poster.
Oh, please. Please do it. Oh, that's such a good idea. I like it. Can I play Emu?
You're prepared to go back under scrutiny
if I'm dressed as emu. What is it?
I love people dressed as emu. Puppets. I was watching, someone had uploaded an old Mash and Peas sketch with Williams and Lucas with Paul Putner as Morph. And nothing is funnier than Paul Putner dressed as Morph.
And he was Curious Orange, wasn't he, as well?
Oh, it's good to see Paul Putner in an outfit. Obviously, the McAuliffe programme has got the Australian Paul Putner in it. There's a guy who looks exactly like
Paul
Putner.
It's uncanny, isn't it? Which makes it even more.
It's a lovely supporting cast. They're good at losing themselves in parts.
Yeah, Ros Hammond's very good, isn't she?
Like, they are just the best. I mean, that's what makes it. It's a proper ensemble.
That sketch where McAuliffe is talking to someone called Kobe and pronounces it Cockburn.
Won't stop.
Pauline.
Sorry, Sean, it's Coburn.
What?
It's Coburn.
Oh, Coburn, sorry. I'm sorry, I've got Cockburn here.
Yeah, it's spelt that way. It's pronounced Coburn.
Okay, spelt Cockburn, pronounced Coburn. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. So the C and the K are silent. I haven't heard of that before, but it's probably just as well, I guess, because it'd be pretty embarrassing, wouldn't it? You know? Hey, does anyone here like Cockburn? Shall I get Cockburn? We're just saying the name Cockburn, I suppose. Cockburn! And Cockburn! Hey, Cockburn!
Fuck off!
That is, she's brilliant. Sorry, at that, isn't she? She's great.
It was perfect. The pent-up old Salvation Army biddy.
Yeah.
Being riled and riled. No, I love her. I think she's amazing.
My other favourite sketches, though, are the courtroom and the doctor sort of spoof dramas.
Yes.
The endless walking around corridors. Basically, there's loads of sort of barristers walking around corridors. Just talking. I mean, it was pre-West Wing, but it was just, it's incredible. Well,
it
captures
high status, low status. There's a lovely, what's the line in one of the court sketches? Constable Evans, if that is your name.
And he also inexplicably wears lipstick and eyeshadow. Mikhailov's character, who's a very serious barrister.
Have you seen his Life of Johann Sebastian Bach? Have you seen that one?
Where he
starts off talking about Bach ostensibly, and then he goes on to talk about how he would have been a great deal less successful as a composer if he had been an underwater sea creature.
And then how he wouldn't have had such a good career if he'd lived on the moon, especially if he'd spent a long time adapting himself to live on the ocean floor. And he ends it, because obviously he's a man who's a fan of comedy. He ends the whole thing by leaving the set. It's a sort of pompous music documentary, up a staircase, and misses the staircase and climbs up the furniture onto the coffee table, onto the wall, which is a joke from W.C. Fields' The Bank Dick. And he's doing jokes from old
silent films. I think that's it. I think the revolving set is... I feel like I'd seen it somewhere before.
I think
Fred Astaire
or so. Or Gene Kelly does a rotating dance. Yes. It's a classic Hollywood. He likes old films and stuff.
I think he's got a very sort of academic approach, and then he's kind of cherry-picked all the best joke. I mean, he is... A lot of it is so trad and in that kind of traditional absurdist...
He changes the title of the programme every series.
Oh, right.
So the first series is the
McAuliffe program.
The McAuliffe program with one M. No, just with one M. The Australian spelling. And then the beginning of the second series, he made loads of jokes about how many complaints they've had about the spelling of it. So it's now spelt the McAuliffe program, PROGRAM brackets, ME close brackets. And then for the third series, he put brackets around the first R in program as well and started referring to it as the program. So he can't even leave the title alone, which is a lovely example of how there's no safe space in this program. You won't be able to move for jokes.
Well, that's it, isn't it? That's kind of like the essence of it. You give him a lot of room, you put some objects in it, or props as they're known, and then watch him go, and he will utilise everything. It's like devising, like when we used to devise our stage shows, and we rehearsed in a church in North London, and we were just sort of, obviously we'd start with a scene, like this is something's happening in a scene and you are these people in a scene, and inevitably you reach for a prop. And because we were in a church and there was a Sunday school around in one of the rooms where we were rehearsing, we just ended up sort of using whatever was to hand, which were some children's bits and bobs, including a basket, which then became a basket of wind, which then, you know, it's just kind of, but he's got that skill. He can't not find a joke in every single object around him. And he's got words, which are funny, and he's got himself. So, you know, actually he is the sort of perfect comedy in one man.
He's just rampaging through, picking stuff up and doing stupid stuff with
everything.
It.
Everything is funny.
Oh, but you're kind of this respectable looking headmaster type.
Yeah.
And you're just throwing, you're basically throwing China at the front row. Which
it only just occurred to me, he shares quite a lot in common with Spike Milligan. Not least his initials. But he's got the thing like the Q, you know, which is a hell of a patchy series. Yeah. It's really patchy. But he has the same sort of attitude to that, which is that this program is, you know, is I can damage this program beyond any.
This is a nonsense, and you're all idiots for watching. Yeah, yeah. Is essentially the message.
It's great because it's a guy, a rep company, and a program that you can subject to any degree of damage. You know, which is great.
But simultaneously, that makes it the lowest possible bar, which is that. Well, it's a load of old rubbish.
Nothing
this is a terrible
matters.
Program. Look at this awful photo of me with my eyes closed behind me, and this is a cheap set, and those wigs aren't very good. And then, at the same time, in terms of comedy, it's the highest bar because the only rule for being in this is this funny. And I think that's what I miss from really good sketch shows, is to watch something where nothing matters apart from the jokes. So therefore, the jokes have to be of an enormously high quality and or even just speed or rate or delivered with enormous enthusiasm, because you're not leaning back on anything else. So in a way, you've produced the lowest quality program using, in comedy terms, the highest possible ingredients, which is effort and energy and ideas and fizz. And
but I guess going back, you go, the message is nothing matters, like nothing is important. Nothing is that important that you would have to dress up for it or put people in prison for it or in any way get anxious about it.
What a liberating thing to be doing. Isn't that what comedy's for? It's the highest. God, we could do with more of that, couldn't we?
But that's why I say it boils down to what I hate most, which is men in authority, like authoritative men. You just go, men in authority, it's just that they're absurd. There you go. There's, you know, they will be crushed by disease and death, and the fact that they sort of have such a high opinion of themselves and set themselves so high above all other humans. You know, that's why I love a character like Mikhailov plays, which is he is ultimately pulling the rug under all those types.
So much comedy comes from that. It starts with people at school looking at the teacher and going, oh God, he's got a big nose and he doesn't know what he's doing. And it's the first time that you've gone, oh, the people in charge, the men with the grey hair, the insurance listers, they don't know what they're doing.
But what you realise is you go, okay, wow, I can wind this person up. When you work out that you have something over them, you go, ah, because you are human. You are ultimately human. I can crush you and I can humiliate you. And that's always my game, is if ever although there are some alpha men that I simply cannot vanquish. That's why I hate them. I can't get through. They are impermeable, Teflon-coated horrors. Well, it's like the communist government of Czechoslovakia, where I also slightly spent some time in my youth. I mean, that was a whole world built like that, of authority and danger and risk if you dared lampoon that authority. And that's why it created some great, sort of very humanist comedy.
You were there before the wall came down.
Yes, I went to school there. Yeah, I used to go and I lived with my grandparents out there as well. But there was a lot of sort of subversive humour that was passed around, you know, person to person, whispered jokes and things like that. And it was sort of kept people going.
It's important.
But it was about the humanity. And that's what Václav Havel was always about. It's like, what is the fundamental humanity? And there was a system that kind of refused to acknowledge any humanity, which I suppose most authoritative systems have to, because otherwise you go, well, then you are just a bunch of people telling other people what to do.
Yeah.
If you don't create that kind of
war. Who put you in charge?
Yeah, who are you telling me what to do? Also kind of seeing people kowtow to that as well, and how it's just amazing how everyone goes along with it, or I guess just for an easy life or something. I don't know. They're not prepared to undermine or lampoon or laugh at it.
That's the key to the idea that there are some things you shouldn't laugh about. And when people talk about that, and they say there's certain things, whenever you're talking about people at the top and you're punching up, you can laugh about that. The things you sort of should think carefully about laughing about is punching down to people already suffering enough.
Yeah.
But genuinely, if you're going to say you cannot satirise or mock our glorious leaders, you go, no,
oh,
you're exactly
on.
Who we mock.
You are totally a subject.
Whether that's a teacher or a parent or the Communist Party, you should definitely, you're exactly the people, and you should be able to, it's the Life of Brian thing, you should be able to take the mocking, because apparently you're so strong and so important.
And
God put you there.
Then what? Yeah.
Then obviously, what I've done there is I've revealed.
Ha ha!
The power!
Ha ha! I crushed you.
And with that expression of Nietzschean will, I might say, thank you, the terrifying Brian Crowe.
Tschüss, tschüssi, tschüss la. Thank you.